pick up in verse number 9. While you're turning there, I'm really hopeful that if you still have that psalm that we read again, kind of in the back of your mind, and that is that psalm that said, grant us grace and bless us so that your way becomes known on the earth. And hopes that as we look at what for many of us will be a familiar parable, we may actually come under its scrutiny in such a way that there's something about us that we've forgotten that the blessing of God is to experience the grace of God, and we often confuse that with getting some gifts from God. That the way we identify that we've been blessed is that we have a lot of stuff. But the songwriter is trying to give us some perspective. It says that the blessing of God is the grace of God, which results in the fact that we give witness to the way of God. So hopefully we may come under a little bit of that stuff. Luke 18, beginning of verse 9. Jesus told this parable to certain people who had convinced themselves that they were righteous and who looked on everyone else with disgust. Two people went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed about himself with these words: God, I thank you that I'm not like everyone else. Crooks, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of everything I receive. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He wouldn't even lift his eyes to look toward heaven. Rather, he struck his chest and said, God, show mercy to me, a sinner. I tell you, this person went down to his own justified rather than the Pharisee. All who lift themselves up will be brought low, and those who make themselves low will be lifted up. Churches should be the most honest places in town, not the happiest place in town. Let me say that again. Churches should be the most honest places in town, not the happiest place in town. Walter Brueggemann said that when he was talking about the Psalms of Lament. That's those Psalms in the Book of Psalms that point to a lamentable experience, one where there is this confusion that we are God's people, but God has expressed himself in his absence, that God has called us his people, and it seems as though he's let others kind of have their way with us, have power over us, have their influence upon us. And while he was talking about the Psalms and the Psalms of Lament, this Old Testament theologian's words fit many texts. For instance, we put too much emphasis sometimes on our piety and pursuit of holiness, and we actually come away misrepresenting the kingdom to others. I probably should define for us and the way we're using it, the word piety and pious. Those just aren't words that we use anymore. But you go back a number of years, and that was the call. The call was to Christian piety. The call was to be pious. Now, you and I hear that word today, and we hear pious, and that's often used as kind of a condescending kind of description. Well, that's old pious Pete over there, you know. And what we're saying about that is that person who they just think that they're having to be better than everybody else, they happen to always do everything just the right way, they're pious. But when the word was common, when it was in public discourse long ago, it really meant that there was someone really trying to be better than they had been. In other words, if they recognized that there were some things in their life that really were awry, things that really were not as they ought to be, and what they were going to do was they were going to apply certain habits and practices so that they might improve their piety. They might improve themselves. They might be better than they were. Piety is not a bad thing. Being pious is not a bad thing. Being self-righteous about your piety is. In other words, all of us probably somewhere along the way could look at our lives and say, there's something about my life that really I ought to be better at. In fact, if you've been a Christian any amount of time, you probably go, man, I should be better than I am after all these years at that thing, whatever it might be. Now, that's not, you know, so we might be guilt-rending this morning, and we might shame each other, but it is to recognize that when we talk about piety, we let outside influences shape the way we think about that. Really, in the ways in which we're using it is sometimes we get overcome and overwhelmed and driven to be better than we are, that sometimes in our pursuits we actually misrepresent what the kingdom really is all about. See, when we set the world up in this way, what we tend to do, because we're trying to measure ourselves. See, if we believe that we ought to be better at something, whether we ought to be better at gentleness or patience or any of the fruit of the Spirit, we ought to be better at those things, and so we undertake spiritual habits and practices that might transform and mold and shape us differently, we always look, how do I know I'm doing better than that? And you know how we do that, right? We measure against everybody else. And so what happens is we create kind of this us-them kind of framework that, you know, those of us who are really trying to be pious, man, we're doing it better than they are. See that? And then that's how we set up things. That's how our conversations work. And if we're not careful, the poem that they read actually gets expressed in that very way we present ourselves. We're really not honest. I mean, the truth of the matter is, we're not as good at what we say we are as we think we are. We're not as good at what we think we are as we portray to other people that we are. So we really create this false kind of perception to ourselves. He says, well, if I'm measuring myself against that person, man, I am really getting it done. I'm really mad. You see, every time we set as our measure somebody else, we create I'm glad we are doing it right, and we at least look and know that they're not. It actually creates illusions in our sense of maturity. It creates the picture that I'm really doing better than I really am. And what happens is we start believing that we're doing better than we are. And we then can't even see our blind spots because we have decided that what we're doing is better than what someone else is doing, and because what we're doing is better than someone else's, everything I'm doing must be right. And this next step after illusions is delusion, where we deceive ourselves in thinking, and I'm probably just about Jesus. Y'all be looking at me. Because I'm just about Jesus. And if we can understand the subtle move, I mean the thin line move, between trying to assess our progress in representing God in the world the way that we should, and convincing ourselves that we are representing God in the world the way we should, is so narrow that this parable really captured it that step is so slight that we could open up this parable and see how it's helpful to us. How we discover that the thing that we should measure against is ourselves. I know you were ready for me to say we measure ourselves against Jesus. But if we're always measuring ourselves against Jesus, guess what? We'll never think we're making any progress. Because there's always some move, there's always some nuance, there's always some turn that will always remind us, man, we aren't making any headway in this journey of faithfulness. But if I'm measuring against my own progress, I can be self-aware, I can be honest. And if the church creates a space where we can be honest that I'm really not where you think I am, and we can really wrestle and own the fact that our progress really isn't as complete as we think it is, it becomes a great place for us really to forge ahead, to really find ways create habits and practices, not just individually, but together, that we can look back at ourselves and say, wow, we really are on the way. We need that, by the way, in case you're thinking that we don't. We need to know the making some progress. You know what happens to us if we don't feel we're making any progress, right? Well, let's see, discouragement leads to despair, leads to abandonment. It's like, okay, done. Why bother trying? And after all, that really is some of our default, isn't it? I mean, we've already come to that place in time. Time would say, well, I'm never going to be like Jesus. Well, yeah, if you don't try, you'll never really be like Jesus. And if you give up thinking that you can never be like him in any way, shape, or form, even in some small way, no, you're right, you never will be. So if we're not measuring our progress, then I don't know that we're heeding what Paul said, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And he wasn't talking about, see if you can't work it out so that you make sure it's done. He's saying, work it out in your life in such a way that it shows up and it looks like something's going on with you. And if our default is always, well, I'm never going to get there, I'm just going to quit trying, then we'll never get there and we'll just one day say, what's the use? But the songwriter's right. And the songwriter says that blessing really is the experience of God's grace so that people might know that way of grace, then we actually have to want to strive to be at a better place tomorrow. And we're going to do like Paul said in the book of Philippians, that we're going to work with everything we have, with the spirit that God gives us, and we're going to try to produce the sorts of things that show some kind of difference has been made because of Jesus. Well, that really depends. Question. So, Jesus tells this parable. And I have to tell you that this parable is, on its face, you know, very simple kind of look. Except at the point at which we start trying to decide what really is the problem with the Pharisee. You see, because what we think about the Pharisee initially, we need to really pay attention to, is how this thing is set up. And so Jesus sets up the parable, and we immediately, because we've been trained to think about the Pharisees in a particular way, we immediately assume when we read that opening verse that Jesus told this parable for the Pharisees. Jesus told this parable for those group of people who became self-righteous and looked on other people with disgust. And we immediately assume that the parable is for the Pharisees. But there was a shift made that drew our attention to the fact that not only were the Pharisees in the crowd, but who else was there? You remember? The disciples. There's a fine line. There's a fine line that's being marked out there. A fine line between being a Pharisee and being a disciple. A fine line. And it really helps us if we come to understand that all was not wrong with the Pharisee. And we if we're not careful, we actually stand at the same wall and we look down the wall. And you say, God, I'm glad I'm not like that Pharisee. And about the time we make a move in our hearts to read this text and go, man, I am glad I'm not like the Pharisee, chances are great. Because the Pharisee actually was someone who was pursuing. In fact, the Pharisee was a deeply religious person who, having read the Torah, believed that their faithfulness to Yahweh would show up in doing the sorts of things that are outlined in the Old Testament scriptures. Now, did you catch that? You see, we have this idea that the Pharisees were a group of people who were just malcontents, hated Jesus, wanted to get rid of him. The truth of the matter is they were the sort of people who really were longing with everything they had. They want to be faithful. And so they read the Old Testament. And they learned, here are the things that we ought to do. And their presence in Jesus' day was actually a reform group. Trying to call everybody else who had kind of come under the sway of what we call Hellenization, that is, really kind of adopting all the cultural habits and practices, kind of giving up on kind of the way of God, and they were trying to call people back to God's way. And when we read self-righteous, we probably need to understand that that doesn't always mean exactly what we invest at. I mean, we think self-righteous, you too, don't you? You identify the person too. Already, well, I mean, when I say it. I mean, that's what happens. Say, man was self-righteous, and immediately, all of a sudden, the visions and faces come dancing into the prayer. Well, I know who he's talking about. Okay. And if he knew what I knew, wow, would he really know how self-righteous these folks were? But you see, there is a way that righteous is used that really is helpful to us to really kind of get a little bit underneath just the very simple idea that the Pharisee was being a hypocrite and being self-righteous. And that is that he had measured his success and progress in piety. How did he do it? He looked at somebody else. I'm glad I'm not like crooks, evildoers, adulterers. Listen, since we like pretty honesty, right? Tell me you've never had that thought. I mean, come on, yeah, I know you must sit at the wall somewhere in front of somebody, been recording, been careful. But you know what you have said? There, the grace of God will alive. Do you get that in that mood we're acting very humble about it? But really it's like, man. I'm glad God's grace has worked to me because that's like a sure ain't giving. I mean, just look at him, and I sure ain't bad. I'm not like there, but for the grace of God. You think that's a really good pious kind of statement. But in reality, it feels very much the same. It has the same effect. Cast judgments, knowing nothing about the person you categorize them as one of the ways in which this Pharisee categorizes somebody as being. Or even just ask for it. You see how subtle this creeps into our own pursuit of transformation? Because if we're always measuring against someone else, we're always looking for a group of people to be better than, to do things that the other group doesn't do. I mean, think about it for just a minute. This is an aside. I thought about this morning. I hadn't really thought whether to interject it or anything. Do you know how loyal we get about and their signs? If you see the documentary about that group, I mean, you would actually, can't believe it. Can't believe there are people playing there. Can't believe it. See how subtle that is? You see, the truth of the matter is, even in their error, they're not honest on you. Even in their error of saying, God hates this and hates those and does this and does that. Even in all of that, we would like to think it as we look at other people. They're just out in the place. And you see that something? If we're always going to measure against other people and not against ourselves, we're always. It's always going to be something that we can be proud of. We're not. Let me say, that really doesn't create great readers in the kingdom. Yeah. I mean, you know, come on, we've got readers, they hand out bulletins and welcome folks and really good at it. And you ought to probably sign up to help do that. We have a big crowd. We could actually be readers and invite people to church. I mean, you know, it's a possibility. But if, in doing so, we have the posture or the disposition where we're always measuring ourselves against the person who comes. You think they can't make that up? You think they can't tell? We've decided already at the outset to do this a little bit better. What have we done here? Oh, yes. But maybe call it survival. Maybe we do that to survive ourselves. But listen, if we've experienced grace and mercy, survival is not an issue any longer. Transformation is. Being different than we were is the matter. It is the issue. soaring over all the influences that make us what they are really no longer takes center stage. I'm measuring against me, having experienced the grace of God. So this Pharisee, here's what he had done. To describe him as self-righteous is he's simply saying, I'm doing it the right way. I'm getting it done. I'm right. Now listen, there isn't anyone in here who has set out to do something that's been effective and efficient at it. You wouldn't tell someone this is the right way to do it. I don't care what it is. If you're good at it, and you accomplish something, you are okay saying, I'm doing it right. That really is what righteous means. I'm doing it right. And in evaluating himself against others, he said, I'm doing it right. They don't appear to be. My life is seeing this sort of progress. Theirs isn't. You see how natural and easy that is? If we want to measure our success and our movement in faithfulness. So the Pharisee wasn't this scrupulous, sinister, unspiritual person. He actually was a person who felt like, I got it right. I'm doing it right. And in the parable, his working with the scribes is with himself. And so he's working with himself. I mean, how many of you grew up like me when the revival was coming to town at least twice a year? And it always a story just like this. Old Joe living on the outskirts of town. Unkempt house, big fence, mean dog. He was an ogreish kind of fellow. He was a drunkard, he was a womanizer, and he didn't treat his kids well. Revival preacher after revival preacher came through town for 25 years. And they always said, take me to the worst person in town. Take me to the cheapest sinner in town. We're going to get that boy saved. And I don't know how bad the first 24 were, but on the 25th try, the guy who came to speak was the guy. So the guy gets saved. They report it. The guy tonight, he comes into the church. He's faithful to his wife. He's wonderful to his children. He's no longer an ogre. He's cut the lawn. He's put up a nice fence. He's painted the house. He's a model citizen in town. He takes stock of his progress. He's been reading his Bible, going to church. He's been tithing. He may have even been doing an occasional other thing or two. And everybody looks and says, wow, how did you do it? Then he looks back and he says, I'm getting it done. I think I want to know about it. Here are the four things you do to progress. I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to see if I can't get on the speaking circuit, and I'm going to conference. And I'm going to go out there and tell folks, this is how you get it done. This is how you do it. And guess what? You all buy the book. Because you want to know, how did the guy go from this to that? And it's very subtle and simple that pretty soon the guy can admit it. And here's how you do it. And you know what we say? Yes. And he'll even say, man, look what God did. See, and that's the magic, to remember how we work. So look at the posture in the parable. Pharisees over here, and we get this picture. The tax collector is way over there. I thought about it. How about the title of the sermon? I mean, you're further from God the closer you think you are. What do you think? I mean, I think it worked, wouldn't it? The Pharisee thought he was getting done. He was really close to God. He had done these things. In fact, in his prayer, he's telling God what God already may know. I do. Ask him. And all I get is. But by the time he gets to the conclusion of the prayer, what does Jesus say? God who's further off is actually closer. I know it's unsettling, but everything we've read up to this point, the upside down break of verse of turn with the you know, powerful. And then Jesus gets to the religious. You go, oh, I might be a powerful loser of power, and I might be a wealthy loser of wealth, but like, what do you mean when the religious lose their religion? What do I do with that? And so here is the public posture. One thinks they're closer than the father, and one thinks they're farther. Closer. I mean, look at what the guy includes. I fast and I tithe. You know, me bad is too fast. I don't have any more time. I mean, listen, understand something. That in terms of spiritual habits and practices, the two that you find in Scripture that express the greatest dependence on somebody else are fasting and praying. Fasting is to be practiced so that we can both focus our attention on what God is doing and how God might be for it. So it's setting aside ourselves and it's embracing a period where we don't need anything else but God. It's that moment when we say, man doesn't live on bread alone, but by the very word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Fasting is that moment, that move, that spiritual habit that says, I'm going to set those appetites aside and I'm going to listen to see if God's got something to say to me about my life. And tithing, well, it's really saying that I can live on less than I make. Yeah, when those Americans can't do that. We can't live on less than we make. In fact, we have to live on more than we make, generally speaking. So do you understand that there is precision in Jesus' words that are the two habits and practices that you find throughout Scripture. In the middle of, get this, in the middle of the habit of praying. They're praying. There's nothing more you live with some Christians than most people. Frankly, most people in the world. Nearly everyone, including you, said to pray. I know you find a lot of music. Prayer is something everybody does, has something about. So in the midst of prayer, Jesus says, the Pharisee says, I fast and I tithe. I do the very sorts of things that you have against it. I'm really dependent on God. See, you see how fine the line is. We love these hypocritical Pharisees. This guy is really, he's really doing it. He's ready for it. He's faithfully practicing the things that make him experience progress. And until such a time as he starts to think, that kind of sense. Just look. He's in league with money. His money is filthy. I can't believe he didn't stand here next to me. In fact, I'm going to make sure that I'm not standing. Tax collector synthesis. You see, he measured himself against himself. He knew what it was about himself. I guess the point really is, on some level, is this is a parable of hyper responsibility. That if our progress is something we measure, then we sure better be measuring against our own selves. We're actually progressing from where we were, where we're headed, and we're getting better at it along the way because of the Spirit of God's word, because of the grace of God's presence, and because we've encountered the mercy of God. Then you can trust that someone's watching and they're saying, now, what about that play? That is the blessing of grace that results in the world getting to see what God's word looks like. Now, that's a great thinking. That's someone who stands at the door and says, yep, come on. Doors open for you. And they can tell the sincerity and the honesty. But we're not just inviting folks in so we can say, man, I'm glad we've got something to do. The church should be one of the most all honest places in town. Not the most happy place. We want to be such because we understand the mercy that we need. Because the sorts of people that we are, that to make progress in the kingdom, we must always be looking at ourselves. And so what Jesus is really aiming at is our disposition, our arrangement, how we set ourselves in relationship to God's expressing himself in Jesus. Because about the time we make a move, we're getting it wrong, we decide we're going to measure Jesus as man. But the invitation is into come do it my way, not what's God. So the parable is pretty important. Because when Jesus said that, he said, that Jesus gave this parable to those who come to the place where they were, they can make a difference. And the consequence was that no one else would succeed. See, I have to think this is probably one of the most critical evangelistic parables in this. Because if there is any way that good news is remarkable and measurable, is that the good news is in full commission and you have to speak this. And if that's the case, God's making his case in you to